The Word of God is often simple in its eloquence. And as we've been looking in this series, we started yesterday speaking about some of the powerful evidences that we have of God as Creator. Those evidences that we looked at yesterday were from the divine pen of inspiration. And I invite you on that note to turn in your Bibles to Psalm 19. I'm turning to Psalm 19 because today we're going to be looking at seven reasons for creation confidence. And we'll be doing it from a perspective that's perhaps a bit different than perspectives that have been taken in dealing with this subject in the past. In Psalm 19, we read the inspired word of the prophet. Of course, everyone who wrote in the Bible is a writing prophet. And here it's very interesting. Psalm 19, beginning with verse 7. I will bless the Lord who hath given me counsel. My reins also instruct me in the night season. I have set the Lord always before me. Because he is at my right hand, I shall not be moved. The psalmist had this confidence that his faith, that his focus was solid, because he had set the Lord at his right hand. And so today, as we look at seven reasons for creation confidence, I want to encourage you with something. How many of you were with us yesterday afternoon as we began this theme together? I see a few hands. Some of you might have been there and not willing to admit it because you're afraid I'll call on you with questions. Don't worry. But yesterday we looked at how critical this area of creation science is in our world today. And why I'm recapping briefly is it's foundational to what we're going to be looking at. I shared with you how we're at a crossroads in the Christian world today. And even as I'm speaking here, Dr. Pippin is speaking down in the Big Ten, speaking about some of these very challenges that we're facing in Christianity. How we're trying to meld in with the world, and often as we do that, we compromise distinctive truths that God has given us. So Jesus' message, yes, was a message of love and acceptance, but it was never a message of compromise. And what we're finding today is oftentimes in Christian circles, we're pulling down standards in the name of reaching the masses. I would like to encourage each one of you, whether or not you've ever been involved in your local church with a creation science ministry, to pray seriously about doing something in a public way in your community dealing with creation science. And I tell you that because of some personal experiences I've had. Steve Kaiser just mentioned that I came here from northern New England, and there I was actually pastoring halftime. I was the associate pastor of the Portland, Maine Seventh-day Adventist Church. And while I was there, one of the things that I was convinced of is the power of creation science ministry to draw a group of people to your church, to your venue, that you're not attracting in any other way. The first time we did a creation science seminar a couple of years ago, we had it actually right in the church, and it was the week before we were going to begin an evangelistic series. We had many people who came to that church for the very first time, because this is an issue that has the attention of the Christian world. And many people in Christian churches that are not teaching a biblical view are looking for something, and we have an opportunity to minister there. So you may feel, well, look, it's great to talk about creation science ministry, but that is nothing that I can do. I don't have the ability to do that. As I look with you at seven reasons for creation confidence, I'm going to especially be looking from the perspective that I have the most credibility, and that's as a physician. So we're going to look at some very interesting things. They may not be the typical things that we talk about. We'll touch on some of those things as well, hopefully in the hour and a half that we have together. But I'm going to focus on some things that are often not dealt with in a creation science seminar. Part of my reason for doing this is to say that you, like me, have a unique experience, a unique background, a credibility in a certain realm. If you're a mechanic, You have a certain degree of credibility when it comes to things mechanical, when it comes to design, when it comes to repairing things. And you can speak from that background to the subject. Those of you that have health science backgrounds, you'll see some of the things that especially connect with me as a health science professional. But others of you come from different disciplines. So try to look at the skills you have. You might say, look, I don't have any credibility when it comes to creation science. No matter how much I know, no one's going to listen to me. Well, then you can be one of the organizers for a program in your church. Are you with me? We need a team of people, and this is a cutting-edge issue. If you didn't hear my presentation yesterday, please listen to it. They're all archived. You don't have to pay anything for it. Daniel, do you know, is it already on the website, or this would be... Okay, so these will be going on to the WeimarTV.org. Is that the best site to go to? And they've also got information on the door of the chapel about the Lifestyle Club. Probably will not be able to access these, is that right? That's mostly health material that's there. But either way, get a hold of that material because it's laying the foundation for the world that we're living in and why this topic is so important. So with that background, I want to give you some evidence from my perspective, things that you can hold on to that give me confidence as a physician in the biblical creation account. And for those of you who joined me yesterday, you remember that my background is one of agnosticism as a young adult. I was raised with an evolutionary perspective. The only mention I heard in my early years and into college about creation science or a recent age of the earth was to ridicule it. I mean, this was common practice in evolutionary teaching that you start out by speaking about how misguided people were in the past and now how much better we know. So this is the kind of world that I was educated in and raised in. Just so you know that my perspective was not one that was steeped in a creation science perspective. But today we're going to look at seven different areas, and we're going to especially spend most of our time on the first four, and depending on how you count, the first four may actually be six or seven in themselves, because point four has sub-points. And for those that might be listening to an audio version of this presentation, let me just read through the list here. The first thing we're going to look at, seven reasons for creation confidence. Number one is an intellectually compelling account of origins. I think this is a fascinating topic. We'll look at it in some detail. It is very rarely discussed in creation science seminars, but I think it's an important one, and all of you have credibility in this realm. The second one is the inability of science to create life. Third is the genetic code. Fourth is a concept that term that's been coined by Michael Behe, some of you know that name, irreducible complexity. We'll talk about that. Behe, when he coined it, was speaking especially of biochemical systems, but we're also going to look at gross anatomical structures, anatomy and physiology, if you will. Talk briefly about the mystery of gender. And the last 3 points are things that you would probably expect to cover in great detail in any creation seminar. We will touch on these, the nature of the geologic column, the catastrophic nature of fossils, and also the whole concept of living fossils. And I may even have a guest co-presenter assist me in some of those final topics. But we'll see how we do as we go through this list. Let me start with the first one with you, an intellectually compelling account of origins. Most people, when they hear the word Bible and creation science, they say, well, that is just fable. This is not intellectually compelling at all. Why would you say this is an evidence that creation science is something that we can have confidence in? The reason I say this is because if you look from a sociological and anthropological perspective at world cultures, you are forced to look very seriously at the biblical record. The Bible account of creation stands head and shoulders above every other indigenous account of origins. I'll give you some examples. This is actually an archaeologic specimen, if you will, of the Enuma Elish. It's the Babylonian account of creation. And if you were to translate that from the Chaldean, Babylonian, or I'm already revealing my ignorance of some of these languages of antiquity, but I have read this in some translations. You'll read about primeval gods like Apsu, the fresh water, and Tiamat, the salt water, the flood dragon. You'd read about their son, Mumu. And you'd read about created gods and battles. And you'd read about the hero of the Enuma Elish, Marduk. You've heard perhaps about Marduk, as if you've studied anything about cultures of antiquity, and how he kills this flood dragon Tiamat and forms the world from her corpse. Is this an intellectually compelling account of the creation of the world? How about this one? This is from Chinese lore. One of the most striking of the Chinese creation stories is that of Pan Ku. And he's hatched from a cosmic egg. Half of the shell above him becomes the sky, the half below him is the earth. He grows taller each day for 18,000 years, and he pushes the sky and the earth apart. And after that, Pan Ku falls to pieces. Fortunately, he's got some parasites on his body, which become mankind. His eyes become the sun and moon. And so some of you smile and you say, well, these are interesting accounts. These are typical accounts. I mean, we could look through many accounts, and even from very, what we would call, advanced cultures. The Greeks, the Romans, their mythologies. Do they give us intellectually compelling accounts of origins? Not really. Now, many people say, well, the Bible really isn't much different. It doesn't seem very intellectually compelling if you've grown up and been raised the way I was, in a world that says, you know, things have existed for billions of years. But I don't want to belabor some of these other mythological constructs, but I want to go with you immediately to the biblical account. And I would suggest to you the biblical account is very elegant in its simplicity. There are no wars. There are no warring factions. There is no slaying of animate objects that are creating the earth. You know how the Genesis account reads. You can just open there to Genesis 1 if you have your Bible. And it's very simple. It's very simple. God said, verse 3, let there be light. And there was light. This simple yet elegant description of a creation by fiat, by God's word. Now you might say that doesn't seem to be all that intellectually compelling. But I would suggest to you, when you compare it with contemporary stories of origins, it should cause you to take note. And if it doesn't, then please look with me at an amazing external validation of the creation account. What is an external validation? Internal validation is where the scripture is consistent, it supports itself. External validation is where something from outside says, look at this account of creation, we need to stop and take note of it. And I would suggest to you, from a physician's perspective, the health counsels that are implicit, embodied in the Genesis creation account, should cause us to pause and very soberly look at this amazing account of creation. Thinking people have to inquire, I believe, if they're honest with the evidence, if you look at the world literature when it comes to origins, they have to say, if you're going to be intellectually honest, you have to say there is something unique about this book. There is something that is here that's not anywhere else. And then when you bring to it the magnifying glass of modern science, we're going to see some fascinating things. You're here at Weimar. And so you know that Weimar is known for, among other things, the New START program, right? Most of you realize that. And I'm one of the physicians in the New START program, as well as one of the teachers at the college. And New START, most of you know this acronym very well. Nutrition, exercise, water, help me out. Sunshine, temperance, air, rest, and trust in divine power. Where does New START come from? Was it something that the founders of Weimar just dreamed up one day, someone was laying in bed and thinking about it? Where does it come from? Okay, many of you say it comes from the spirit of prophecy. The spirit of prophecy did endorse this concept. But where are the roots of New Start? That's right, they're in creation. They're in creation. We're going to take a look at a few examples, but I want to remind you of something, and that is the cultural context of the book of Genesis. Cultural context. So the cultural context for the book of Genesis is the culture of Egypt, right? Moses, the author of Genesis. You might say, well, you know, higher critics, they say that Moses probably didn't even write it. There are probably multiple sources that wrote it. But no matter what position you take, the cultural milieu of the book of Genesis, no matter who you say the author was not a culture that valued the elements that are described in Genesis 1 and 2 as being the ideal creative state. Let me just give you an example. We'll take at face value that Moses indeed was the author of the book of Genesis. I believe he was. But even if someone debates this, let's look at the Egyptian culture. We could have just as well looked at the Greek culture, the Roman culture, the Babylonian culture, other dominant cultures that may have influenced whoever some higher critic wants to say wrote it instead of Moses. Are you with me here? So let's look at how the Egyptians lived. We're talking about the wealthy Egyptians. Moses was in line to be king, right? So how was he living? What were they trying to surround Moses with? Well, if you read the archaeological discoveries, the insights that we have of that culture, the Egyptian nobility lived much like Americans are living today, whether you're nobility or not. They had an abundance of leisure, a lack of exercise, and they had liberal consumption of animal products. Let me show you. This is a description. An author, an archaeologist, writing about the world of Moses. The book is called Everyday Life in Bible Times. Here's how the wealthy Egyptian's home was described. The manor house was designed for light and airiness. They sat on chairs and dined at a table. They could take their leisure in an arbor of the garden, listening to a blind harper chant a love song or an old heroic tale. No TV, no DVD players, right? No CDs, whatever, no MP3 players, but they had live entertainment, and they enjoyed their leisure. What else did they do? Well, they would go and watch other people exercise, very much like our culture today. Here's one of the exercises they watched. They put their perfume on. It was provided by cones of sweet-smelling ointment that gradually dissolved, apparently, on their heads. They went to these gala dinner parties. Each guest was assigned a servant. Some think that was because they were the air conditioning, you know, fans. That was the servant. So they'd be, if you get hot, we'd call for the servant to fan you. And the high point in the entertainment was not being plied with food and drink to the full, but the high point was when acrobatic dancers, scantily clad girls came, specializing in the high kick. It sounds like contemporary society, doesn't it, in many ways? What about the diet of the wealthy Egyptians? So they had a life of leisure. They enjoyed their entertainment. Some very interesting insights from both archaeology and art as to what Egyptians ate. Here's one description. While the food of the common people was barely adequate at best, and during the recurrent corn dearths, sadly lacking, the affluent certainly knew how to live it up. Meat, waterfowls, vegetables, fruit, and wine were part of their diet, as was the ubiquitous, ever-present bread in one of its guises. Where did meat come from? Meat came from domesticated animals, game and poultry, probably including partridge, quail, pigeon, ducks, and geese. Here's another illustration from antiquity, from Egyptian times, of some of their foods. And you can see the prominent part that animal products had in that diet. Here's a stone carving of an Amarna princess, eating roast duck. I've been spending too much time in the kitchen with refrigerators instead of with archaeology. Amarna, not Amana. Okay. This is an interesting illustration. This is many scientists known as paleopathologists, have studied the mummies of Egypt. And one of those mummies is believed to have been infected with trichinosis, that is believed to have been contracted from his eating of pork. The Cambridge World History of Food speaks of the long history of pork use in the Middle East. And it says from earliest archaeological records of pork use, they've been concentrated in the Middle East and Eastern Mediterranean, dating back well over 3,000 years. This Cambridge World History of Food goes on to tell us that pork, many believe, is the most savory of all flesh foods. So it's not a stretch to imagine that Nebuchadnezzar was serving that in Babylon. The abundance and quality of fat keeps the meat from tasting dry and imparts a characteristically rich flavor. Why are we looking at all this? We're looking at it all because whether you want to talk about Babylon, Greece, Rome, whether you want to talk about Egypt, which the Bible says was the contemporary construct in which the book of Genesis was given, I would like to suggest to you the description of an optimal lifestyle that we find in Genesis 1 is totally countercultural. Let me tell you one last thing, just for those of you that have been thirsty today. I see some of you with your water bottles. How many of you know what the preferred Egyptian beverage was? Do you have any insight into this?
Beer.
Okay, I hear someone saying beer. Any other guesses or insights?
Coffee.
Wine. Well, let's take a look. What was that preferred Egyptian beverage? Here's some statements. The mouth of a perfectly contented man is filled with beer. That's an inscription dating to 2200 BC from Egypt. Here's one, some wisdom. The instruction of Kethi, an Egyptian wise book, if you will. This is what the student is warned. When you eat three loaves of bread and swallow two jugs of beer, and the body has not yet had enough, fight against it. Wouldn't be quite the temperance message I hope that you're presenting in your circles. But beer, a prominent diet. For those of you that are school children, I see at least a few of you perhaps here. If you were living in Egypt, this is what would be waiting for you. It said, the mother was told that after she sent you to school, when you were ready to be taught writing, she waited for you daily at home with what?
Bread
and beer. Okay, beer was a choice article of beverage in Egypt. Now, with all that background, I want to invite you to remember the dramatically different view of lifestyle as presented in Genesis 1 and 2. To me, this is really truly remarkable. When you look at cultures of antiquity, what is described in Genesis 1 and 2? Cultures of antiquity prided themselves on their physical prowess, on their ability to defeat their enemies. Is there any warring in Genesis 1 and 2? No, nothing like that. And we read about these simple lifestyle elements, this New Start regimen. What was the only beverage mentioned in the Genesis account? Have you thought about it?
Water.
It's water. That's the only thing that's there. Genesis 2, 10 through 11. Speaks of that river that came out of Eden. Pure water, the only beverage mentioned in the Genesis account. I told you yesterday about how all of the Bible underscores the truth of the Genesis creation story. If you relegate Genesis to myth, you, in essence, throw out the entire Bible. All the Bible writers speak of Genesis as fact. And we looked yesterday, you remember, at Acts chapter 3, when Peter is giving that great sermon, he spoke of the plan of restoration. And so as you look at the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, you see these very same elements of lifestyle being restored. Let me just stop for a minute. We're speaking about water. What would the average Egyptian think if you were telling an Egyptian nobleman that the ideal created state had an abundance of water? What do you think they would ask? Where's the beer? I'm serious. And so what I'm trying to help us see here, those that would have us believe that the Genesis account is just some figment of a social, cultural setting. I would say the very text of Genesis militates against it, and instead it speaks about a profound, health-giving, optimal health lifestyle from the very beginning. Are you seeing that there's something unique about the Genesis account that is not present throughout the other views of creation throughout antiquity?
Amen.
And we could go through example after example of this. I shared with you how the Egyptian nobility frowned on exercise. This has been true of most cultures. And not even many years ago in America, it was true of our culture. You know, nowadays, even if someone feels it's frowned on to take care of their lawn, they'll pay someone else to do it and go to the health club because they know better, right? We're a culture that's becoming aware of the importance of exercise. But most cultures throughout history, including the Egyptians and the Greeks and the Romans, who did all the manual work? That's right, the slaves, the lowest people on the totem pole. And so in Genesis, we have this amazing account where God puts Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, and what are they doing? They're gardening. They're doing manual labor. This is countercultural. This, the Genesis 1 and 2 account is not something that can just be explained by the culture in which the people live. This is not what they would have written. God is giving an inspired account of origins. It is the most intellectually compelling description for how we got here in all of antiquity. And as a physician, as I look at this, I am amazed. Because not only what we find in the book of Genesis, but it's re-echoed throughout Isaiah and Revelation as it speaks about recreation. It's telling us that God's purpose and plan, His design for this earth has not changed. There is going to be pleasant labor in the earth made new. What kind of work do you think Adam and Eve did in the garden? How would you describe it?
Gardening.
Useful work. Right? Manual. Physical labor. Where were they doing it? They were doing it outside in the fresh air and the sunshine. Do you know there's actually evidence today, just for a medical aside, that some of the very best exercise that you can do is indeed outside exercise, useful work. You say, well, all I can do is go to the health club. I mean, I live in the city, you tell me. Well, listen, whatever exercise you can do is good. But, you know, if you get outside, you get the benefit of sunshine and vitamin D and fresh air. And what is useful work? What also does it do that walking on the treadmill doesn't do very good with? Are you aware?
Your mind.
Your mind, yes. We're a very stressed society. And although walking on the treadmill is good for the mind, your mind can easily run in a track that is less than conducive as far as stress management. You see? Or, if you're like most people, you're not letting your mind run at all. You have a television set, or you're listening to your MP3 player, whatever. You say, well, I'm memorizing scripture. Well, that's very good. Don't let me argue with you about that. But the amazing thing is when you get out and you work and you do something useful, your mind is engaged. It's much more stress relieving. When you're walking on the trails here at Weimar, hopefully, if you're just visiting here for the first time, you're exploring some of these beautiful trails. When you're walking on those trails, you have to concentrate where you're walking. It's not like you're walking on a treadmill, and it's nice and flat, and you don't have to worry about it. You have to be engaged. You have to be involved in nature around you. So, to me, this is profound insight. That in the very beginning, God is providing a program that was designed to minister to a people that the biblical account says were intended to live forever. It's implicit in Genesis 3, isn't it? Because when they're banished from the garden, they're banished for a specific reason. You remember what it was? That's right, so that they would not continue to partake of the tree of life and be immortalized as sinners. So the context clearly indicates God's intention for eternal life. And it was not just ministered to by that tree of life, but also by the lifestyle God gave them. Well, what about diet? Did Genesis 1 and 2 give a picture of diet that was different than that which was valued in antiquity? Would the average Egyptian say, wow, I mean, this sounds like a great diet. What is there in Genesis 1 and 2? You know, in Genesis 1:29, it describes what kind of a diet? A vegetarian diet. Very interesting, isn't it? What cultures of antiquity aspired to be on a vegetarian diet? Were they the Romans, the Babylonians, the Greeks, the Egyptians? I mean, do you see that there is something intrinsic in Genesis 1 and 2? And I'm looking at it, of course, from a physician's viewpoint, but it speaks to us that there is something unique here. And I would suggest to you, with this first point, reasons for creation confidence that we're looking at today, the very account of the biblical creation, the lifestyle that God gave there in the beginning, the diet that the Bible indicates will be reinstated for all of humanity, as you read from sources like Isaiah 65 and Isaiah 11. No more death, no more destruction. What the Bible is talking about is an amazing account of origins that blows anything else away that I've ever read. And I've read a number of sources that look at world views and origins insights. So, my conclusion is, and you could debate it if you want, but my conclusion is simply this, when we look at this first point. Anyone who has any cultural or anthropological awareness should, if they're honest, say, look, there is something different about the Bible. There is something compelling here. There's something intellectually compelling if I just look at this. This is not just some ordinary fable about how the earth came to be. No matter how amazing it may sound, no matter how incredulous it may be to the minds of individuals who've been told that we've been here for millions upon millions of years and things evolved over eons and eons of time. Does it seem that I'm making too big a point out of this very fundamental concept? Are some of you getting worried about this? It looks like you're at least my friends. If you disagree, you'll disagree with me in private. But I think this is an extremely important concept, and I don't hear it articulated typically when we speak about creation science, but to me is a compelling, compelling bit of evidence. So an intellectually compelling account of origins. While we're mentioning that, how intellectually compelling is the prevailing view of origins among non-Christians? Or, for that matter, among even most of Christianity today? What is the prevailing view of how we got here? Isn't it this, the Big Bang Theory? Isn't that what they believe? I mean, that's what I was taught. I don't know whether they used those terms when I was growing up. Seems like it's always been around, but I know they continue to modify things, and I haven't looked to check my textbooks from childhood. But is the Big Bang concept, is that more or less intellectually compelling than the Genesis 1 and 2 concept? You say, well, we're Christians, and so Genesis 1 and 2 is more intellectually compelling. But I would just say objectively. I mean, try to look at it objectively. And the Big Bang, basically, in some respects, is not all that much different than that Pan Ku legend from China. Starting with some kind of a cosmic egg. Now you say, well, I'm taking great liberty with my metaphors. But really, the concept of the Big Bang, and you can read, this is from not a Christian source, it speaks about the cosmos going through a super fast inflation in fractions of a second. Expanding from the size of an atom to that of a grapefruit in a tiny fraction of a second. Moments later, and this is what they're calling time begins. Okay? Then they say, post-inflation, the universe is a seething hot soup of electrons, quarks, and other particles. And this is all happening in fractions of a second. I mean, tiny amounts of time. Then a rapidly cooling cosmos permits quarks to clump and into protons and into neutrons. And it goes on and explains this concept, this framework of how the Earth, the universe is just exploding, if you will, in this big bang. And then things begin to combine and form together into universes and galaxies and solar systems. Now, if you just look at some of this from a, I'm just saying, is it intellectually compelling? I mean, from a very simplistic perspective, someone would say, if you've got things that are moving at these infinite speeds from this common point, what is going to cause them to become attracted together and to form these galaxies and solar systems? And most cosmologists, people who look at the beginnings of things today, speak of a universe that's still expanding or accelerating. And so I just ask you a question. Is this an intellectually compelling explanation? You say, well, Dr. DeRose, it's intellectually compelling if you really understand, you know, relativity and you understand physics and mathematics, and this is very intellectually compelling. Well, if you go to any creation science book, they're going to talk with you, remind you of some of the laws that govern the universe. Now, what is a law? What is a law when we speak about it? What is, we call gravity a law, don't we? What is the law of gravity referred to?
Something we just found out.
Okay, it's something we discover, we didn't cause it. It's something that's unchangeable, that's fixed. It's a physiologic principle, a physical principle of the universe. The second law of thermodynamics is also known as referring to entropy or disorder. And the concept in this second law is that things go from an ordered state to a state of disorder. That they do not go in this direction from disorder to order unless there is some kind of input into the system. And, you know, people will say, well, you know, that's a closed system, an open system, we have different dialogues about this. But the point is, what we're really being asked to believe when we speak about the Big Bang is something totally contrary to anything we see or we experience. And we're being told that it happened that way because great minds believe this. Now, one interesting thing about cosmology and how we got here is the more we learn, the more the science changes. The explanations that were so obvious 50 years ago have now been thrown out, and now it's so obvious for any intelligent person it's different. Let me give you an example from the medical realm. Some years ago, I was invited to take part in a national dialogue about the value of dairy products in the diet. I was told I was being asked to participate in this dialogue with these other scientists because they knew that I had come to the conclusion that dairy was not an optimal thing to include in our diet. And I was given a very, quote, prominent role in the program. I was in a panel discussion at the end of this whole day's worth of discussions. As I sat through the lectures, I was amazed at how the deck had been stacked in favor of the dairy industry. They had all these eloquent dairy spokespeople, researchers that were telling how much we needed milk in our diets. And I don't know how they found the people that they did to speak in favor of a total vegetarian diet, but I've never, at least my impression was it was just a disaster. Why did they have these people speaking? They weren't giving very good arguments. They weren't presenting it in a very compelling way. But as I sat there and I listened to the dairy industry, it was very interesting. Because what they continued to speak about is how safe dairy products were. And as I was listening, I knew the history of dairy safety. And they were, when they were talking about how safe dairy was, that there could never be a salmonella outbreak from dairy, I was thinking of those thousands of people that some years before had been sickened in the Chicago area with salmonella traced to dairy. And what I was realizing is what happens is every time there's a major outbreak linked to dairy products, they change their way of dealing with dairy to make it safe from whatever the last outbreak was. Are you following along here? Now I tell you that because this is the same thing that happens with cosmology. We're told how this is intellectually compelling. And we're said, if you don't understand it, it's just because you're not smart enough. You see, if it doesn't seem to make sense to you, you don't have a PhD in physics, and that's what the PhDs in physics are saying right now and in mathematics. But the problem is, the PhDs, 50 years from now, will all be saying something different. Because what happens is, the prevailing view of science, what happened in the past, which is something we can't explain, we can't see, we can't test it, right? We can't go back in time and test what actually happened. And the more we learn, we find that our understanding is incomplete of these things. So here's the question, really, that it's starting to boil down to. What is really more intellectually compelling? And I would suggest to you, for the average person should be very much aware of this concept. And I would tell you this, whether it's medical science, whether it's creation science, whatever it is, beware of explanations that don't make any sense because you're not smart enough. Okay? If you go to the doctor, and the doctor tells you you need surgery, and you say, but doctor, why do I need my gallbladder removed? And the doctor says, look, I'm the doctor. I've examined you. I've studied for many years. Your gallbladder needs to come out. If you don't want to take my advice, you go somewhere else. What is the implication of that type of communication?
Find another doctor.
Yeah, find another doctor. That's what I would actually advise. I mean, it's shocking to me as an internal medicine specialist to sometimes take a past medical history of people. And people will have various surgeries, and I'll say, what did you have that surgery for? And they'll say, I don't know. The doctor said it needed to come out. Okay? I mean, it's shocking to me. Now, I hear that less these days than I did probably 20 years ago. But the point is, if people are telling you it would make sense if you just knew as much as I did, you should be very worried. You with me? So what I would like to suggest to you, is that ultimately you are going to trust someone when it comes to origin. And you say, well, Dr. DeRose, you're trying to give us reasons for creation confidence, not that just that we're going to trust someone. You're trying to give us some intellectually compelling thing. But the bottom line is, I don't care how smart you are, there's going to be things that you're going to never understand. Am I right? I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, there are people that I greatly respect in the area of creation science, but they don't know everything. There are certain things they don't understand. And ultimately, you're going to have to say, I want something that's intellectually compelling. Yes, I want evidence to support it, but there's going to be some questions I can't answer. And just because I can't answer the questions doesn't mean that whatever view I embrace is not intellectually satisfying. Are you with me? There is no system that answers all our questions. Because think about it. If we were able to answer every question about the origins of the universe, even from a biblical perspective, who would we be? We'd be God, wouldn't we? Exodus said it very simply. Moses was very anxious to know what to communicate to the children of Israel. Who was he speaking with? What was his name? God says, I am that I am. I'm the one who's always existed. I am the self-existent one. And it's in effect, God is saying, you know what? I'm going to give you plenty of evidence for a biblical perspective. But there's going to be questions. Don't focus on what you don't know. Focus on what you do know. Let's go to this next one. We're looking at reasons that we can have confidence in the biblical view of creation. We spent a lot of time speaking about the first one. I really believe, from a cultural, anthropologically, the scientific perspective, the biblical account of origins is intellectually compelling. Second one, inability to create life. What the evolutionary worldview says is that there was this primordial mixture of elements that just formed spontaneously into life. Now, we have serious questions about this because no one has been able to create life even if they're controlling all the inputs. Now, someone says, well, wait a minute. You're not up to date, Dr. DeRose. Didn't you hear the headlines just a few weeks ago, May 21, 2010, covered on all the major news outlets and news wires? What were the headlines? Craig Venter's team creates life. How many of you heard about that? Okay, I see a number of you. They created life. What was amazing to me was to read about it in Time magazine. Here was the title, Scientist Creates Life. That's a good thing, right? Look what they wrote. It's even more amazing what they wrote. By the way, before we read some of the material from Time, at least CNN on their website had the integrity to quote Venture himself, and he said very succinctly, we didn't create life from scratch.
Yeah, I saw that.
You saw that, didn't you? Yeah.
It's essential.
Yeah, yeah. Look at how Time, though, builds this. It's the ultimate, this is how the story started in the article, it's the ultimate science experiment, really. Taking a handful of chemicals, mixing them in just the right combination, and presto, life! After nearly 15 years of such toiling in his labs in Rockville, Maryland, J. Craig Venter, co-mapper of the human genome, has done just that. Oh, come on now. I mean, what kind of problems? When you read things like that, and then you even read what the article described, you say, what kind of problem do these people have? They're talking about people that believe in a biblical worldview having their mind closed, and it's as if, even the way they describe things, that they're uncomfortable with the lack of evidence they have supporting their view, and they have to write something like this. I mean, this very article goes on and explains exactly what the scientists really did. Scientists had, before this work, had deciphered many codes, genetic codes, the chemical DNA signals that tell what proteins to make in order to make an organism. They have identified the entire genome, the whole genetic message for different organisms, and this particular organism that was worked with was in the Mycoplasma family, or genus, more precisely. So Mycoplasma, it can cause a pneumonia, some of these germs, but this one was being used in research. And then what they did is they actually, because they knew what the genetic information looked like for this organism, they then reconstructed this organism, this genetic sequence in the lab. But unfortunately, they were not skilled enough to be able to do that themselves, so they had to recruit not only pre-existing DNA that they could use as templates, but they had to use actually the machinery of yeast and other bacteria to actually join together these fragments. Now, don't misunderstand me. This is really an incredible scientific accomplishment, but it is nothing like creating life from scratch, as the article indicated. And finally, after they make this DNA with the assistance of other living organisms, then what they do is they take a fully functional living bacterial cell, take out the genetic material from it, put in the new genetic material, and this organism starts making and living like the programmed information in its DNA. Venter described it this way, we transplanted it, the assembled DNA, into a recipient cell. And that new chromosome, that new genetic information started being read by the machinery in the cell, producing new proteins. Had life been created? No. What did this really actually show? What it really showed is absolutely nothing about the spontaneous creation of life. What it did show is that an intelligent designer could assemble functional DNA. That's really what it showed. And in fact, they had to use living organisms to do it. You see? So this that's being heralded is this great scientific achievement. I'm not saying that it's not an incredible scientific accomplishment, but it surely tells us nothing about origins. Man has not created life, and attests to nothing remotely close. Let me introduce you to someone. If you haven't heard his name, you want to take note of it and learn a bit about Dean Kenyon, PhD. Dean Kenyon has a very impressive pedigree. Professor emeritus of biology at San Francisco State University, PhD in biophysics from Stanford. He was a research associate with the NASA Ames Research Center, visiting scholar at Oxford. He's received National Science Foundation grants. What Ian Kenyon devoted his life work to for most of his career was working on this very issue of the origins of life from primordial soup. In fact, Kenyon wrote what was the classic textbook on this subject called Biochemical Predestination. It's referring to this concept that if you have got the right chemistry, it's just a foregone conclusion, what's going to happen? Life is going to spring out of it. This was what his life work was. And the interesting thing, though, about Dean Kenyon, in spite of all the work he did, and by the way, just to, if you know some of the people that are credited with so-called proving that you can develop living molecules like amino acids out of primordial soup, you'll remember the name of Operin. When individuals like this, these international caliber scientists, retire, they have a special going away party, if you will, and they invite other peers, other scholars, to be involved in putting together their Festschrift works. And we just lost one of our German-speaking audience members, so could give us a good translation from the German of Festschrift? Anyone help us? Schrift refers to writing. I think Fest is some celebratory writing, but I don't want you to trust my German translation. But it's something that's common in the academic community to have this special celebration, if you will, and special chapters are written. And who wrote chapters for leading experts in their field of primordial soup giving rise to living molecules but Dean Kenyon? Well, the interesting thing about Dean Kenyon today, and to my knowledge he's still alive, is he's authored one of the major creationistic textbooks. After devoting his life, a good portion of it, to proving that you could take things from this primordial soup and get life out of it, that's what he was working with, he realized that this is not possible. And he's a creationist writing creationistic literature. Dean Kenyon is just one of many people who, as they put their resources into this model, this prevailing model, they're saying it is not intellectually compelling. Ultimately, it becomes intellectually bankrupt because the dots don't connect together. And all these lines of evidence don't come together as clearly as the simple statement, God spoke, and it was. So, Kenyon gives us an example of a world-class scientist putting all his energies into demonstrating that the evolutionary worldview is valid and coming to the conclusion that it is something that is not scientifically valid. Well, let me go with you to our third reason I believe we can have confidence in the biblical view of creation. And it's an amazing example of design in nature. We're really getting to many of these arguments from design that are in number four, but the genetic code is something truly remarkable. How many of you know the name of Dr. Tim Standish? Dr. Standish is with the Geoscience Research Institute, and if you go to their website, which if I'm not mistaken is just Geoscience Research Institute, GRISDA, I think .org, GRISDA.org, does that sound right, Karen? Dr. Standish has put many of his presentations there, and some of these slides are taken from one of the PowerPoint presentations that you can download from that website. What Dr. Standish is looking at here is something that has been known as an explanatory filter. And when we look at things in the world, how do you decide if something just happened by chance or if it was designed? Have you ever thought about that question? If you walk out and you see you're walking through the woods, for example, here at Weimar, and you see some beautiful shrubs and trees, is it obvious to you whether they were planted there or whether they just grew spontaneously? Can you tell? Okay, some of you are nodding your heads yes. In some cases, it may be very obvious. If you see a finely manicured garden, right? This is not just something that spontaneously arose. You would say this was designed. But other things may be more difficult to explain, right? If there's a beautiful tree out there in the woods, how would you know if it just grew there spontaneously or if some considerate person planted the seed? That might be harder to determine, right? Well, Dr. Dembski has this explanatory filter. And basically, he has you walk through several questions. If you see something and it's highly probable, you can essentially depend on it for the most part, that's at the level of a law. Okay, so if I drop a book or an object, is it going to fall to the ground? Yes, the law of gravity. Now you say, well, you know, Dr. DeRose, if you're, you know, in a certain situation, maybe you're, you know, orbiting the Earth and you're in a spacecraft, there might be no gravity. Well, you understand the point. The law of gravity on this Earth is a law. It's highly probable. When you drop something, it's going to fall. How about something of intermediate probability? What would an example of that be? Let's say flipping a coin. If I flip a coin in front of you and I get heads 5 times in a row, is that highly probable that I get 5 heads in a row? No, so it's not a law. We would say that's chance, wouldn't we, to get 5 heads in a row? How about if I keep flipping the coin 100 times and every time it's heads? What would you say? What would you want to do? Yeah, you'd want to look at both sides, right? Because you'd say, just by chance, we wouldn't expect that to happen. It looks like something of that nature must be designed. I want to see the coin. And so, Dr. Standish, he's a biochemist, if I'm not mistaken, has looked at the way that God communicates in the cells. He's a Christian, so he's attributing this to God, and I would as well. Looks at DNA and RNA. We've been speaking a little bit about this, but the language of life, if you will, DNA is that material that Venter's team reconstructed, and the DNA has to be read. It has to be transcribed. It has to be made into messenger RNA, and then there's these transfer RNAs that are used to reconstruct from these signals protein molecules. And life is basically controlled by proteins, by enzymes that are made from proteins and other important molecules. The language of life, this DNA, is made up of molecules that are composed of a sugar group and a phosphate group and a base. You thought you'd never have to look at this again after basic chemistry or maybe even organic chemistry. But the place where things differ is in these bases. And you've got these two families, the purines and the pyrimidines. And I don't want to go into much detail with you because I know this is already too much for some of you and it's boring others of you who know all this. But there's basically 5 different bases that are used in the genetic code, 5 different letters. And those letters are assembled in different sequences that are then translated into protein signals. The translation is done by what is called transfer RNA, looking at codons, triplets of these bases. So here's a triplet, 3 bases, adenine, guanine, and adenine, and that codes for a particular amino acid, which just happens to be arginine. You say, what does all this mean? Well, if we were to look at this transfer RNA, it's a large molecule. You see it illustrated here. And there's this recognition site. It's called the anticodon, illustrated there at the bottom. And at the top, in this illustration, is methionine. So this anticodon is going to recognize 3 base pairs in the DNA, and it's going to stick an amino acid called methionine in the protein chain that is being coded at the appropriate point. Now, for many of you, this might be gibberish. For others of you, it's review. But let me try to make it very simple. All body processes, all life processes are encoded in these messages in DNA and RNA that are found in every living organism, essentially.
Okay.
Now you, we'll say essentially. And the point is that in order for that message to be translated into activity, the specific sequence on that DNA strand or that RNA strand has to be interpretable by other mechanisms in a cell. And those other mechanisms then have to read instructions and then put a protein in a proper sequence. It's actually an amino acid, a protein building block. For those of you that aren't familiar with proteins, proteins are like trains. They're made up of cars. Just like a train, the cars are the amino acids. The train is the protein. You following along here? So if you mess up and put in the wrong car in the train, could it affect the function of the train? If you put a caboose in instead of an engine, could that be a problem? Yes, it's the same with amino acid substitution. So when you hear people talking about mutations, mutations can cause changes in the protein structure. Now, why does Dr. Standish say that biochemistry and the genetic code provides evidence of a creator? I want to show you something. I'm just going to go right to a table here that Dr. Standish has constructed. And you may not be able to see all the detail of this, but what he's illustrated here is the 64 different combinations you can have of these 4 to 5 letters. It's actually 4 letters in RNA and 4 in DNA. You can have 64 combinations of these letters. You can have UUU, uracil, 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 etc., UUC, UUA. What is being illustrated in this graph is that when there are changes in these letters, it often does not change the protein that's being coded for. In other words, it looks as if the genetic code was designed to minimize the impact of mutations. You see, mutations are generally bad. They're generally destructive. How many of you have heard of hemophilia? You heard of hemophilia? It's a bleeding disorder? Yes. Hemophilias, often caused by single genetic mutations, a single change in a gene that then codes for a different protein and makes a certain clotting factor abnormal. So mutations are generally destructive. And what, from a biochemist's point of view, who's not closed to seeing design in creation, Dr. Standish says, to me, this looks like someone designed it. It does not look like just chance, some random thing that developed. And by the way, evolutionary thinkers have great difficulties explaining how the genetic code came to be. And if you want to read about that, and there's all kinds of theories that, you know, RNA started first in an RNA world. But really, most of them are not very intellectually satisfying if you're open to the alternative, that there was someone that designed the genetic code. Are you with me? So, Dr. Standish is making this point. If you want to look at his whole presentation, you can do that online. But I think it's a compelling bit of evidence in favor of the Genesis account. And I'm not going to go into some of these other things that I've included in some of the slides. And I'm happy to share things with you, too, if they're of interest from what I'm presenting here. Dr. Standish has done some math about the odds of this, these assignments just being random that we've just been looking at, and it's a number so large, the odds, 10 to the minus 85. That's 10 with 85, 1 with 85 zeros after it and a 1 over it. I mean, this is an infinitesimally small number. In medical science, if you have 1, if you have 10 to the minus 2, that's considered highly statistically significant. That's a p-value of 0.01. And in medical science, 0.05 chance of it occurring only 1 out of 20 or less is considered to be statistically significant. So this is huge odds that this does not look. You would look at it and you would say, this looks like it's chance. It's like the guy flipping a coin. How many times? You know what the odds of flipping heads 1,000 times are? I don't know, I haven't figured out the statistics, but I don't know if it even will come out to 10 to the 85th. That's a really huge number, okay? So you start looking and you say, if someone showed you something like that and you say, this just happened by chance, what the logical mind should say is, come on now. You know, who's cut the coin? You know, who's got the two heads on it? You see what I'm saying? So, let's go on to this next point, and that's irreducible complexity. This is something that I told you Michael Behe coined. How many of you know Behe's name? Are many of you familiar with him? It looks like maybe a minority of you. This is a 10th anniversary edition of his book, Darwin's Black Box. I think it was first published in 96, if I remember it correctly. And here's what Behe wrote. The simplicity that was once expected to be the foundation of life has proven to be a phantom. Instead, systems of horrendous, irreducible complexity inhabit the cell. Behe is not a Bible-believing creationist who believes in a literal Genesis account. I'll show you some of his statements in a few minutes. He's a biochemist. He's a university professor out on the East Coast. And what he came to the conclusion was that based on biochemistry, there is no way that you can believe in the theory of evolution. There is no way that small successive changes can do things on a biochemical level that need to happen in order for life to exist as we now see it. In Behe's book, he talks about how, you know, the evolutionary theory actually can sound pretty compelling to someone who doesn't have a lot of scientific background. You see, it's interesting, because they want to tell you you don't know enough if you question the theory, but it's really only simplistic thinking that it makes most sense to. If I say, couldn't you imagine how an eye could form, just maybe there's a photosensitive spot on the skin, and maybe it just got a little bit more sensitive, and maybe there was a cupping in a certain organism, and it made that spot, you know, concentrate the light a little bit more. And you hear explanations like this, and you say, well, you know, maybe that could happen that way. But what Behe's saying, and he talks about things like that, he's saying, you know, you can talk about all this stuff in an anatomical framework, you know, from gross anatomy, from large structures, but if you look at the biochemistry, it's impossible. There are huge leaps. He says the resulting realization that life was designed by an intelligence is a shock to us in the 20th century. Remember, he wrote this in the late 90s. Who had gotten used to thinking of life as the result of simple natural laws. Behe quotes, as he looks at biochemical systems, Charles Darwin. And Darwin said this, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And in commenting on this, Behe says it very eloquently, to Darwin the cell was a black box. Its inner workings were utterly mysterious to him. Now the black box has been opened up. He's speaking about biochemistry. We know how it works. We know cellular biology to a great degree. Applying Darwin's test to the ultra-complex world of molecular machinery and cellular systems that have been discovered over the past 40 years, we can say that Darwin's theory has absolutely broken down. And what Behe does in his book, and it's quite a readable book. He's got a lot of the science in there, but it's written in such a way that if you don't want to read the science, he kind of shows you how you can skip that. But he talks about these irreducibly complex systems. And here's his definition of it. Irreducible complexity is seen in a single system which is composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, and where the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning. He likes the illustration, actually, of a mouse trap. And Behe points out that if a mouse trap were to evolve, could a mouse trap evolve? I mean, think about it. A mousetrap is only functional if all its parts are functioning. You see, if you don't have the spring, how well does a mousetrap work? Does it work? No. If you don't have a catch there to hold the holding bar, will the mousetrap work? No, and you can go on and on. And what Behe is saying is, look, for a mousetrap to work, everything has to be in place at once, or it has no useful functional purpose. And he says it's the same thing as you look at a variety of biological biochemical systems. There's absolutely no way that something would just occur and be preserved because it has no useful function unless the whole system is brought up to speed at once. And some of the examples he uses, one is the cilium or the flagellum. The cilium are those tiny hair-like structures that are in the respiratory tract. The sperm has cilia that are associated with it. Flagellum, the kind of tail whip of certain organisms. Blood clotting, cellular transport, how things are transported, shuttled in the body, and the immune system. Behe says all of these things are irreducibly complex. You can't have it just develop in serial fashion. And one of the illustrations he provides is the flagellum. Okay, this is this bacterial structure, supposedly structure found in very simple organisms. And if you actually look at this, it looks like a very complex motor, you know, with a universal joint and a propeller and a rod and a drive shaft. And really, it's an amazing, remarkable structure. And if you look at this, you say, well, how would these parts just come together and become functional? Now, tomorrow, we're going to speak about destroying some of the arguments that evolution says invalidate the view of origins presented by the Bible. And there are some people that have tried to say that, oh no, this could happen in little serial steps. And actually, they really don't give any serial steps at all. They just cite a certain bacterial toxin injection system that is most likely a degenerated flagellum structure. But that's getting ahead of the story. But if you look at many of these systems in biochemistry, molecular biology, we walk away with the conclusion that this most likely was not just the product of random chance accumulations over millions of years, but it occurred how? By design. It was purposefully designed. This is what Behe said. Now, but look at Behe is not a biased, quote, biased. This is what the secularist would say. He's not a biased Bible-believing literalist. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with being biased by the Bible. Okay? I would hope that we're all biased by the Bible. We hope that that's helping to guide your worldview. But look at what Behe says. I find the idea of common descent, that all organisms share a common ancestor, fairly convincing and have no particular reason to doubt her. So what Behe is saying is I believe in, you know, in general, in evolution. The idea that the designer had to have made life recently is not a part of the intelligent design theory. So what Behe is saying is, look at, you know, a lot of what evolution says I really believe in. You know, it could have taken millions and millions of years, but you know what? There's no way evolution alone could explain life the way we have it. It's impossible. That's what he's saying. As a biochemist, there's no way that this life could have just evolved from some primordial soup. He said, you know what? I mean, all the science teachers say it was billions and billions of years. That's what I was taught. I can live with that. But I can't live with the thought that it just all happened all by itself. Do you see his argument? To me, it actually strengthens Behe's case. Because he's not trying to push just a very literal biblical agenda, which I believe is true, and I believe there's evidence for it. But what we're looking at here is someone who does not come from that perspective saying, look it, just biochemistry alone says Darwin's theory of evolution falls flat in its face. Now, while we're speaking about Darwin's theory of evolution, do you realize that everyone who describes themselves as an evolutionist today does not really believe in Darwin as he articulated his theory of evolution? They speak about neo-Darwinian theory, and they've actually had to modify Darwin's theory. We're not going to have time to talk much about the fossil record. We will be talking about that some tomorrow. But it's very interesting. Darwin expected to find many transitional forms, because if you look at most trees of different species, you'll see that they don't have any identifiable common ancestor in the fossil record. And Darwin expected that you'd find a lot of these things, and they haven't been found. So now we have people giving us theories, telling us that, and to me this is amazing actually, and we might want to speak about this in some detail tomorrow, but one of the prevailing theories is something called punctuated equilibrium. And basically what punctuated equilibrium suggests is that evolution really takes place in spurts. Great jumps happen, and they happen in tiny closed populations that you wouldn't expect to find any evidence of. So in other words, what you end up with is a theory that says its support, the support for the theory, is that there's no evidence of it. Okay? I mean, this should cause you to be highly suspect. I mean, shouldn't it? If I said, look, the way I can really prove this to you is you go on the fossil record, you won't find any evidence of this, and this is exactly what I'm suggesting. I'm giving you a model where you wouldn't find any evidence of it. Now, I'm not saying there isn't any validity, there are some principles that have some truth, but I'm simply saying that the biblical view actually has compelling intellectual evidence behind it. Look at what, I think we'll come to this point here, about gross anatomy. I don't want to take a lot of time with this, but you know, we could spend a whole hour looking at all kinds of different anatomical constructs in the human body or elsewhere. And if you look at the circulatory system, Behe was speaking about biochemistry and a cellular level. But if you just look at human circulation, I'm not going to go through a bunch of slides that I have on this, but just four things about our circulatory system I'd like you to think about. We have a four-chambered heart. We have valves. We have circulatory flow. How dependent is our life on a functioning heart? Yeah, it's a stupid question, right? Okay, no heart, you die. Unless you're hooked up to some artificial machine that is circulating and oxygenating your blood and making sure it gets adequate nutrition as well if it's for a significant period of time. So what's so interesting about this is how do you develop gradually a heart? Now you say, well, there's all kinds of theories about how that would develop, but think about it. Does a partial valve work? Some of you have partial valves, and you've been told you have to have surgery, valve surgery, because you're going into congestive heart failure, and you need a new valve because your valve isn't functioning properly. Some very interesting thoughts as you look at the circulatory system. Cardiac electrical activity. Are you aware that every one of us has a single pacemaker in our heart? Naturally. It's called the sinoatrial node in the upper right-hand portion of the heart, the right atrium. Interesting that if that stops working, you have backup mechanisms in the heart, and backup mechanism after backup mechanism. How does this evolve? How do backup mechanisms evolve? And it's very sequentially designed, so that if your heart rate isn't staying between that, you know, maybe 50 to 100 range, we usually say 60 to 100 is normal, but it's probably below 50, where some of these other tissues typically start to take over and start pacing your heart at a heart rate maybe of 48 or 50 or something. And if those pacemaking cells fail, other cells of the heart that tend to fire at a lower rate take over. Very fascinating, the design in the heart. How do you have backup systems in an evolutionary model? Then what about fetal circulation? If you want to study something amazing, look at how circulation changes the moment a child comes out of the womb. It's absolutely amazing. doors that are opening and closing. You have a ductus arteriosus and a septal defect, an opening between the upper chambers of the heart. And there's all kinds of things that immediately, as the lungs fill with oxygen and pressures change, these flaps close and things close down. And if they don't, you need to have heart surgery. If they don't take care of themselves in a reasonable period of time. So what is going on? How do you have things that are orchestrated to change at birth? How do you explain that from just an evolutionary standpoint? You say, well, the old explanation was ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And that sounds very erudite, very scholarly. And what they were saying is, you know, if you look at what's happening in the womb, it's going through the early phases of life. Well, this has been totally invalidated. This is not what's going on at all. You're never a fish as a fetus and then become a reptile and then become more like a bird before you become a mammal. Okay? But the point is, marvelous design in the fetal circulation that changes instantaneously, essentially. And then you look at how the heart is interconnected with other structures, like the baroreceptors, the pressure receptors, like in your neck. How does your pressure stay relatively stable when you change position? You see, you have a problem with that. You get lightheaded if you sit up too quickly. But normally we have these pressure receptors. The nervous system and the heart are interconnected. How do these things develop? How does something just develop from an evolutionary standpoint that then is going to connect with the brain and with the heart? Do you see? As you start to look even at a gross anatomy, you say there are tremendous problems with the evolutionary model. And you would say that as you look at these different lines of evidence, for me, I see compelling evidence of design. Now, I have spoken with you, especially today, and I thought I actually would cover what I did perhaps in a little shorter order, and we would get to speak about some of the geologic things, which we will look at in more detail tomorrow. But often we speak about geology, and I think there are compelling evidences there, as well, as I mentioned, and we'll look at some of those things tomorrow. But I want to say, from the standpoint of medical science, from a reading of the Bible, and from just an understanding of science in general, I think the Bible gives us the most compelling intellectual account of origins. And I say that, like I said, from the perspective of someone who is an agnostic, and it was the Bible that actually helped me to see that there was something more to life than just chance and coincidence and evolutionary activity that led to my being here and to you being here. Hopefully this has given you some further food for thought, and the areas that are lacking, you know, when we do a creation science seminar, we like to do it at least over a whole weekend, where we do multiple presentations, like on a Friday night, all day Sabbath, if you're doing it in a church setting. So to try to touch on these things in short order is very difficult. And if you're like me, probably the thing you most wanted to hear you didn't hear about, but hopefully you heard about some things that you maybe hadn't thought of in the same way before. But the bottom line is, God is giving abundant evidence that we can trust his word. Not every question will ever be answered, but there is plenty of evidence to say that the biblical account is intellectually compelling. And on that note, let's take a moment and pray to our Creator together. Father in heaven, as we open your word, as we open the book of nature, that's what science really is. And as I do that, it just seems so often that we only scratch the surface. It seems like there's so much more that could have been said, or maybe even should have been said, that so far has been left unsaid. And even though we have an hour and a half tomorrow to study further on these themes, we realize that it is such a vast theme that it really calls for us to pay special attention to this cutting-edge truth in the day in which we live. The Bible is under assault. Your word is saying that it's not trustworthy. But this afternoon, we've glimpsed from the world of science, at least from my perspective, reasons that we can have intellectual confidence as we come to the Bible, that we don't have to check our brains at the door of the church and feel like we're just believing carefully crafted fables. But instead, it seems as if much of the world, and myself in that group at one time in my life, had largely closed our minds to what is intellectually compelling. As we look at history, as we look at worldviews of how we came to be, Father, help us to see that there is depth and wisdom and truth in your word, that we don't have to be ashamed to share that with those around us, and that we can have confidence that when you spoke, that we can believe that those are indeed the inspired words of our Creator. We thank you for that assurance. In Jesus' name, amen.